Welcome to the Providence College Podcast. My name is Joe Carr. Today's guest is Professor Richard Grace, a Providence College institution and icon. Dr. Grace arrived at PC as a student in the fall of 1958, and except for a few years studying for a doctorate at Fordham, has been here ever since. Now an emeritus professor in the Department of History and Classics, Dr. Grace is sort of the college's unofficial historian. Building off the work of his friend and colleague, the late Dr. Donna McCaffrey, Dr. Grace chronicled the second half of the college's first century in the centennial book Values That Endure, published in 2017. He joins us today to talk about the college's history, including the pandemic that presented significant challenges at the institution's birth. The year 1918 has been discussed a great deal lately in the context of the horrible flu pandemic that the world had to deal with at that time, but that was also the year between PC's charter and its opening. What do we know about the effect of that pandemic on the birth of the college?
Well, the college was chartered in February of 1917, and 2 months later, the country went to war against Germany. And many of the local fellows who were drafted were from lower income levels, immigrant families to a great extent, who would have seen Providence College as their opportunity for a higher education. And they were going off to war, and World War I, which looked like it was going to take a few months to be polished off, was going on year after year after year. And so there was no telling when this group of young men was going to be able to come to college. The construction of Harkins Hall was partly because of money the Dominicans had, and the bishop gave them some money as well, but they needed a whole lot more money, and that had to be raised through 1917, 1918. Ultimately, it cost about a little more than $6 million in today's currency, and it was dedicated in the spring of 1919, in May of 1919. And by that point in time, a lot of the young men had been demobilized and were, you know, back eligible for attendance. Now, the question about the flu and the vulnerability of the college to effects of the flu was strongest in the fall of 1918. The flu actually had a considerable bearing on what was happening on the front lines in Europe, because a lot of Americans died from the flu. And the German army, which was making its last big effort, was really decimated by the flu in midsummer of 1918. So the war is over by November of 1918. The troops are coming home. Harkins is under construction. The question is, how devastating is the flu going to be? And as far as the young men were concerned, it wasn't so terrible as they might have anticipated. And the big question was whether it was going to affect the building's trades so that Harkins couldn't be completed in time. As it turned out, that didn't happen. Nearly 1,000 people died in Providence from the Spanish flu in the fall and winter of 1918-19. But the health issue was largely resolved by the spring of 1919, and the college got to open in September of 1919. This is a question of vulnerability of the college at certain points in time for health reasons or financial reasons or internal disputes or whatever. We can go into that as you like, but there's the story of 1918-19.
It's a theme for people who study history, isn't it? How peoples overcome very difficult times and emerge in some cases stronger. What does history tell us about people who are able to manage through times of terrible strife like this, like that was, I should say?
You know, we're in the middle of a situation now, which is going to give us a really good lesson. And the uncertainties of the moment require decisions to be made or decisions to be delayed. And you have to live with the consequences of those decisions. If we can move back to a prior instance, which is about halfway between the Spanish flu and COVID-19, there was a episode epidemic of flu in 1957, in the fall of 1957. And in fact, I lost a week of school at that point in time. I was a senior in high school then. Providence College had just acquired the big residence properties from the House of the Good Shepherd, Joseph Hall and Stephen Hall. And Stephen Hall downstairs, where there are now classrooms and the copy center, that was a giant lounge. And I learned from Father Gardner back at that time that the flu was so extensive on campus in the fall of 1957 that they turned that big lounge into a giant infirmary. Now, I guess there wasn't much social distancing possible if they put something like 50 cots in that lounge and downstairs of Stephen Hall. I tried to find something about it in back issues of the Cowl, but all I could find was that Joe Mullaney couldn't get his basketball team to practice because so many of them were sick. But that wasn't, that flu in 57 wasn't as severe as what we're experiencing now.
Richard, let's talk a little bit about what you've called the changing face of PC. It began with, as you described so beautifully, just one building. And now look at it, 105 acres of just beauty and function and everything one would want in a contemporary college campus. An amazing transition in 101 years.
Yeah. I was thinking just the other day about the naming of places. That's a big issue when colleges construct new buildings nowadays. And I was thinking that when the college opened, they wanted to name the original building after the bishop who had sponsored Matthew Harkins, who had sponsored the establishment of PC. And there was nothing else to name except to one thing. Can you guess what it was? That's a question to everybody. Can you guess what the other thing to name was? It was the baseball field. There was only one building on campus that was Harkins Hall, but the previous bishop of Providence was named Hendricken, and so the baseball field came to be named Hendricken Field, and it served as baseball field for the whole 20th century. So the rest of the land is a wilderness at that point in time. The Bradley Mansion, which we call Martin Hall, was there at the time. That was the home of the Attorney General of Rhode Island during the Jacksonian period in the 19th century. But otherwise, this is a pretty naked landscape, and it builds with acceleration in the early part of the 21st century. So it seemed as though we were adding a building almost every year. And as a wise guy, I was going to refer to Father Shanley as Brian the Builder in the history that I was writing. I was asked not to use that term, so I scratched it. But I think that my old friend, Father Shanley, deserves so much credit for the changing face of the landscape. There are now, if my tally is right, 46 buildings on campus, on a 105-acre campus. And when the new plan for the college was presented to the city back in the 1990s, the agreement was that the college was not going to be spreading in a kind of cancerous way into neighborhoods, taking over properties. And so this is, at least for the foreseeable future, the footprint of Providence College. And you know, various developments have taken place to use the available property without wrecking the landscape, which is very beautiful. The first week of May is always the prettiest time on campus, and it was hard, only a handful of people there to see it this year, but those people who come for graduation have usually missed the very peak, which comes at the start of May, and the landscape of the campus is, I think, pretty handsome. It's been a nice place to spend my life.
Indeed. We have a question from one of our friends with us today. Richard, what can you tell us about the Chapin property? What kind of a hospital was that? That's now what became the lower campus buildings, as we used to call them, Dorr Fennell. Howley and so on.
Charles V. Chapin Hospital was named after a 19th century doctor who was the director of health in the city of Providence. And the hospital served many purposes. It functioned for general medical purposes. It had a tuberculosis ward. It had a ward for psychiatric purposes. And so it fulfilled lots of functions. The students who have taken a walk in past years, when Donna McCaffrey would give a tour of the campus and take people through the tunnels and so forth, will know that there was a morgue down there. And the morgue at Chapin Hospital eventually became the ceramic studio at Providence College. But the various buildings in Georgian style left us a nice architectural legacy when the college acquired that property.
Like any institution, I'd like to go back to a phrase you used a few minutes ago, Richard, that is moments of vulnerability. PC has had its share, for sure. Yeah. What have some of those been, and what was the impact, and how did the college recover from the most difficult of its times?
One that I would point to right away is what happened in World War II, because as an all-male college, with the draft in progress and the numbers of students who could enroll being so badly diminished that in 1943, only 66 students were in the incoming class that September, the college went to 3 semesters in the course of an academic season because there was anticipated so much shuttling in and out of students who were going off to war or perhaps coming back having left the services by virtue of being wounded or whatnot. And so the college changed its academic calendar for that year. But the big question was survival financially. And what rescued the college was the Army Specialized Training Program in 1943-44. I don't know how many there were altogether, but a lot of troops were brought in for various kinds of academic work. They were taking classes in the college and living in Aquinas Hall. And that really saved the college from, being right at the brink financially in 1943. The program was ended in 1944 I saw a picture years ago of all these servicemen marching from PC down to the train station. The purpose of that happening in the spring of 1944 was that they were all being shipped to Europe for the invasion of Normandy. In that year of 1944, Congress passed the GI Bill of Rights. And that meant that when so many of those servicemen came back from Europe, they were able to enroll at Providence College with government tuition benefits. And that really injected a whole new kind of life in the college with so many young men, particularly local young men, who were given, I think it was 3 years, I'm not sure, but I think it was 3 years of tuition benefits upon enrolling. The college continues to have a program for veterans. It's administered through the School of Continuing Education. PC is listed as a yellow ribbon school at the moment. And so even though the ROTC program isn't as large as it was back in the 1950s, there is a continuing ROTC program and this program for veterans benefits, which the college and the government contribute to. So that's a long-winded way of talking about what happened in World War II.
Among the many World War II veterans who used the GI Bill to attend Providence College was somebody who ended up having tremendous impact, and that was Joe Shanley, right? Shanley's brother, class of 46.
When I was teaching, I still do teach courses in World War II, but going back 20 years, there were still people alive who could come to class as primary sources Larry Guzzi's wife was one. She was strafed by an American fighter plane when she and her father were on a road in South Germany. Joe Shanley was a radio man on a B-19 bomber. There was one time, I'm telling too many tales here, but before the line of primary source people died out, as it has almost completely died out now, in back-to-back weeks, I had a Holocaust survivor from Barrington and an SS corporal from Fall River. So bringing those people to campus was exciting for the students and for me as well.
Let's take a little time to talk about some of the dramatic moments in the college's history. And we have actually a few questions, more than a couple, that relate to 50 years ago, right now. So the class of 1970 was about to graduate, Kent State happened. You were a young faculty member, very involved in dealing with that and helping the students deal with it. Tell us a little bit about those days.
I wrote a few questions on my pad for quizzes that I like to give. One of them is kind of playful thing, but the other two are much more serious. And one involves the major developments. So for all of you out there, think for a moment, what would you think were the major turning points in the history of the college? And I know that from looking at the list of people attending, the comments suggest some things that are very personal for individuals and some things that are big issues for the college. So this is a big issue. What would you say were the major turning points? What was, after the founding of the college, the single most important turning point in the history of the college?
We had a quick answer, Richard. I'll throw it at you. And here it is again, the admission of women and
absolutely.
Co-education. So, you're going to have to give out high grades today.
Absolutely. The admission of women changed the college in so many ways. You know, it occurred in 1971 when young men from PC were still being inducted into the Army so that they went virtually from graduation to the jungle. And so there was a kind of heavy atmosphere on campus in those years, partly because of the worry that the guys were going to get their degrees and then they were going to go off to get shot up in Vietnam. And the admission of women had a huge academic effect on the college, but it also had a wonderful effect on the atmosphere, on the general atmosphere of the college, because there was a kind of leavening of that gloom that existed. You know, at that point in time, I was directing the honors program, and the last all-male classes in the honors program were those fellows who were who knew that they had gotten a bad number in the draft lottery and that they were going to be sent overseas in all likelihood into combat. With the arrival, and that showed up in the discussions in my honors classes, there was a really heavy kind of tone about discussion much of the time, ultra serious. I mean, not surly, but ultra serious. When the women arrived, the seriousness didn't leave, but a kind of relief from that heaviness that was affecting the campus all-male population was achieved. And in addition to that, the effect of women on the academic life of the college was just gigantic.
Another couple of other of our audience pointing out, of course, the Aquinas fire, 1977, obviously a very dramatic moment in the college's history, and another one where you were very involved with the students in helping them get through that.
Well, that was going to be one of my other questions, what the most dramatic moment would be in anybody's experience over the years. I suspect that some people would cite a very personal moment, but in terms of the life of the college, I asked this question of the honors alumni of 1980 when we were talking a few weeks ago, and they responded instantly as a chorus that the fire was the most dramatic thing. And the second thing they mentioned was the blizzard, which came only 3 months after the fire. But you know, the fire was a defining moment in the experience of the college for people who, let's say, graduated in the 60s or the 50s who are participating today, or people who graduated in the 90s or beyond. It's a part of the college history. For people who were alive at that moment, like Father Shanley, who would have been a sophomore at that time, it left a lasting mark on their lives. You know, that it was at that point in time that the word family became so much more common in conversations about the people of PC. Father Peterson regularly used the word family, and it became common thereafter to talk about the people of PC as a family. I remember that morning of the fire going to my office, which was downstairs, and Stephen Hall and various faculty members drifted in. And ultimately, there were about a dozen of us there, and you know, people kept asking, as did students and other people who were PC supporters, why did God let this happen? And nobody had an answer.
Let's talk about some happier moments.
Okay.
How about some sports championships, for example?
Okay.
You can start with the NIT in the 60s and run through hockey in 5 years ago.
I went to every NIT game I could go to in the 1960s. And I was thinking this morning about, you know, how we react to sports. I don't think, personally, I'm speaking personally now, that it's necessary for a team that I cheer for to win the ultimate championship game in order for that team to be considered an exciting team to watch. You know, I can go to Fenway Park and I'm happy if the Red Sox win the afternoon or evening game that I see there. And in a sense, it doesn't matter if they get to the World Series, because I've seen good baseball. Well, I was thinking just this morning about those NIT years, and I wonder if some of you will remember this play that I'm about to describe to you. It was, I believe, a game against St. Louis in the 1960 NIT. And PC, I was sitting behind one of the baskets, and PC got a rebound. The ball was handed over to Johnny Egan, who used to tear at breakneck speed down the court. He started that breakneck speed down the court toward the other basket, spotted Lenny Wilkins about 50 feet ahead of him, and lofted a pass behind his back and over his head halfway down the court. And Wilkins got it and scored. And it's the best basketball play I've ever seen. those were exciting years at the NIT. And what I suppose one of the most famous pictures of PC sports is a picture of Vinnie Ernst standing at the foul line in a Holy Cross game in 1961. And I was sitting over to his left in the stands, and I could see the people up in the first balcony shaking the supports for the basket. And so Ernst missed the foul shot. And the referees didn't intervene to give him another, but he was involved in every scoring play from through the overtime, and PC won the game.
It's a great shot, which is prominently displayed on the wall in Harkins Hall, just outside the president's office.
Yeah.
So
yes.
Walking on the second floor can see that one for sure.
Let's,
and by the way, I know you were very pleased and proud just 5 years ago when Nate Lehman's hockey team won the NCAA championship too. That was a great moment for Friar sports.
Oh, it was. You know, I remember the first time PC was in the NCAA hockey final. It was in 1985, and it was against RPI. And I was living in England at the time. I was on sabbatical in Cambridge, and I was at the There it is. That's 2015. Yeah,
that's the guys. That
such an exciting moment. Let's describe what happened here for those of you who weren't watching or never got a chance to understand what happened. PC was trailing by a score of 3-2 with about 9 or 10 minutes left in the game. And one of the PC players was trying to get to the bench for a line change. And so he lofted a soft shot toward the BU net just to buy some time for the line change. Mm. Well, the goalie caught it, the BU goalie caught it, but dropped it. And it fell between his feet and trickled across the goal line. So the score was tied. And a couple of minutes after that, another PC player lined the shot over that same goalie's shoulder, and the score was 4-3 in PC's favor, and the team was able to withstand a blistering attack by BU with an extra skater in the last minutes, and the result was the victory that you just saw in that picture.
Brandon Tanev scored that game-winning goal, now an excellent National Hockey League player, so he's doing great things. And
right.
Let's not forget, by the way, the great success in women's sports, in two NCAA championships in women's cross country under the great head coach, Ray Tracy.
Yeah, the first two NCAA team championships that PC enjoyed was for women's cross country. And they were for runners from all over the world. And I should also mention that while we're talking about hockey at the beginning of the 20th century, the women's hockey team was the dominant hockey team, collegiate hockey team in the East. They won the last ECAC tournament they were in, and then for the next 3 years, they won the Hockey East Championships. And so women's hockey really had a tremendous stretch early in the 21st century.
I'd like to go back to questions, Richard, and just putting a couple together. I don't think we can answer them exactly as they're posed because they're about policies relative to naming buildings. But can you tell us a little bit about some things you've observed about how the college has decided on the names of buildings, who will be honored by having buildings named after them?
Yeah. Sometimes it's as a result of donors making, like the Ryans with a business building, or the Ruanes with the Ruane Academic Center and the Fryer Development Center. In other instances, buildings have been named, well, the names have been inherited, let's say, when the Good Shepherd property was acquired, and names have been after Dominican saints like Raymond Hall or Aquinas Hall or Harkins Hall after the Bishop of Providence at the time that the college was established. So the names, you know, come from all over the place. Donors, saints, saints donors.
Former presidents. We have
former presidents. Yeah, I was on the corporation at the time when the field house was being built, and Father Peterson was president at the time, and Bishop Gelinau, chairing the meeting temporarily, asked Father Peterson if he could leave the room for the moment. And he suggested to the corporation that they name the field house after Father Peterson. So when he came back into the room, he found out that he was going to have a building named after him. Named after former presidents. And one of the names that always tickles me is Fennell Hall, because Father Fennell was the bursar of the college for many years. I think he smiled once a year. I don't think I caught any of them. So he was ultra serious money manager for the college. But Fennell, which is the most easternmost building on the campus, is named after a bursar of the college.
This is kind of general, but I know you have some observations on some of the characters.
I've lost the sound on your end, Joe.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Is this affecting anybody else?
Well, let's see.
OK,
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, yes.
But I can't hear you yet.
That isn't good. That isn't good.
So let's see if we can fix that.
Somebody let us know in the chat if they can hear me, please.
No.
Well,
I'm trying again.
Well, okay. People can hear me and everybody except the most important person.
I'm not hearing you at the moment.
Okay. Well, I will keep talking for filibuster for a moment, Richard, and see if we can recover this and just describe some of the things that we are planning to continue talking
okay.
about, which includes.
So maybe it's on my end that the sound has gone.
It does seem like it.
So. Okay. All right.
Well, friends, let's see how Professor Grace does here on his own.
Dr. Grace.
Okay.
Can you? Okay.
I can hear now.
Perfect. Right. Back on track, right?
Right.
Excellent. So, some of the characters, the great people, the faculty, Dominicans, other people who have been in your universe since 1958.
I'd like to have a quiz now. Okay. I'd like to give people a quiz, and this is for Dominican nicknames. So I'll give you the nickname and give you a second, and then I'll pass on to another, and we'll finally assign real names to them. How about the Duke? Okay. How about the Bush? How about the Turkey? And Mickey Mouse? How about 59? And the monk? Okay, I'll tell you who they were. There are some other nicknames, but
I think I know one, Richard.
There's one I'm holding back.
Okay, I have a guess who that might be too. But was the Duke Father Schneider?
It was Father Schneider, yeah.
God, the father of Friar Hockey.
After whom, that's right, yeah. He, you know, Father Schneider, whom I had for elementary German, looked like he was a gruff man. He was really a sweet man, and hockey was much of his life. And I think he was a good friend to the young women who lived in the house of the Good Shepherd, you know, kind of like a chaplain for them. The Bush was, for those of you who are history majors, Father Hinnebusch, who was known as a rigorous teacher of history. The Turkey was Father Koskren, not for any academic or personal reason, but because of his gait, because of the way he walked. Mickey Mouse was the rector of St. Joseph Hall, Father McHenry. 59 was Father McGregor, whom students thought favored 59 as his favorite grade. The monk was Father Mahoney, who lived downstairs in the basement of Joe's and was victimized one day to come out of his room and get hit by a hockey puck from the floor hockey. But the one that you're all thinking of, I'm sure, is Wacky Wally. Now, is there anybody here who doesn't know who Wacky Wally was? Father Walter Heath was in the philosophy department, and he really was a philosopher, although he liked to say, I'm as ordinary as mashed potatoes, but he was a very eccentric fellow, and he came to PC after he had been a submarine commander in World War II. There are many tales that students have invented about him getting his ship hung up on a submarine net in Tokyo Harbor and all sorts of crazy things like that. But he told me one time that he was finishing the training school for submarine commanders, and the ship assignments were being handed out. And the commanding officer got the alphabet confused, and the next person in line was named Kramer. but the commanding officer gave Kramer his ship assignment before he gave Walter Heath his ship assignment. And Walter Heath told me that is why Kramer is at the bottom of the Pacific. And I'm here talking to you. He also told me that when he got home from the war, he lived in Boston, a greater Boston, and he got home and, his mother was so happy to have him home. And he told her that he was going to go out to buy some civilian clothes the next day. And she said, "What are you going to use for money?" He said, "Well, I've been sending you my pay all the while I've been in the Navy." She said, "Oh, I don't have that. I gave that to the missions." he drew big numbers of students to the masses that he said on the weekend in the old Aquinas Chapel. I remember being there for a 7 o'clock mass, which was jammed because the students knew that the homily was going to be something unusual. And I remember him talking about eternity and saying to the students, "Now think about what it would be like to be all alone with your soul." And there were guys banging on the pews, laughing, and he got them to come to church.
I remember that word, for some reason, somehow, word used to spread during the weekend when Father Heath would be celebrating Mass. So yeah. The legend built upon that. So it was standing room only in Aquinas Chapel.
For all his eccentricity, he was a very thoughtful man, and he was really a living philosopher, not just an academic philosopher.
What about some of the faculty members, Richard, your colleagues over time? Tell us about some of the characters there.
Oh, there's such a collection of characters, and this could be another quiz for those of you who are listening in. I think that I've just seen one pop up on the screen. I think that in the last 20 years or so, our faculty has been largely devoid of the colorful people who used to be members of the faculty. I think that in my memory, the modern language department would probably come out on top of the colorful people because they had so many people from so many different places. And among those people, you had, a Vichy Foreign Service officer from Southeast Asia, a German lawyer who was an interrogator for American forces after World War II, a man who invented a kind of cough syrup. There were lots of eccentric academics and some very talkative people. There was one Dominican whom I won't name, but when people saw him, it would cause a change in their path on campus. If they were walking from, say, Stephen Hall to Harkins Hall, they might go by way of Alumni Hall just so as not to be cornered by this man who would talk in a monologue for a half hour before you could escape. But one of the really colorful characters I'd like to mention was a former television figure. His name was Frank Hanley. The students called him Pops because he liked to tell stories in class about his days in television and his days on the stage. And he was a great raconteur so that he could make a 15-minute story out of a trip to the barber shop watching one of the priests get his hair cut, that sort of thing. Frank was a lovable fellow. Who didn't own an automobile, and going someplace with him could be risky because his directions might lead you to a completely different place.
But you were very fortunate to be joined today by a good friend of yours, Roy Peter Clark, from the class of 1970, retired senior scholar at the Poynter Institute, and also a 2017 honorary degree, the same year that the college bestowed that same honor upon you. And Roy says this: "Our class takes credit for student activism that brought about reform of the corporation, reform of the curriculum, and co-education. Do we deserve it? And speak more broadly about the influence of student activism."
Student activism could be mischievous. It could be very serious. And Roy is right in saying that so many important changes happened right around the year that he graduated, which is 1970, that they can take some of the credit for the change in the curriculum. In the fall of 1971, a lot of important things happened to the college. Most important was the admission of women students. Secondly, the introduction of a new core curriculum, and quite apart from student activism, the opening of the Slavin Center as a student center that the college had never had before. And so he's right. Student activism in a political way showed up most significantly in the student resistance to the Vietnam War. And that was very active, nonviolent on campus, but very active, very vocal, and came to a climax in the spring of 1970 when classes were suspended at the end of the semester because of what had happened at Kent State.
Incidentally, a few weeks ago, Roy was kind enough to write an essay to the members of the class of 2020, those graduating 50 years after him.
I read it.
And it's spectacular. I'll post a link to it in the chat here, but Roy draws parallels between 1970 and 2020. The two classes could not have a standard graduation, and right. There are other things in there. And he's an amazing writer. It's just a really great piece to read. So I encourage people to do that if they have the time.
The graduation in 2020 had to be deferred. There was a virtual degree ceremony online, but deferred until the end of October. In 1970, the graduation took place in the grotto. And the speaker on that occasion was Art Buchwald, who was a satirist for the Washington Post. And he did what the students asked. I'm wondering if Roy had a hand in this, but the students asked Buchwald to talk about the war. And so he said what he planned to do was to say every optimistic thing that somebody had said about the war in Vietnam, going back to 1954. And so he did. And, you know, the United States was deeply engaged in the war in Vietnam at this point in time in the spring of 1970. And students were, many of them, waiting to be drafted. And so there was no prospect that the war was going to be ended soon. But he started lining up every optimistic statement about the light at the end of the tunnel, which presidents and generals and Vietnamese leaders had been saying, and American leaders and so forth. And by the time he got finished, everybody was laughing, and laughing very strongly, because, you know, obviously all these statements were not amounting to anything like the light at the end of the tunnel. So the students got what they wanted from him.
Question, Richard, several versions of this, but I'll use this rather general characterization of it. Can you share some thoughts, reflections on the Catholic character of the college as it is now and as it has been?
Okay, yeah, that's an important issue, because it's come up a couple of times in the last 30 years. And you can see from the comments of students who responded to the invitation for this that the Catholic character of the college is pretty high on the agenda of alumni. And the question that became so serious in the 1990s was whether it was important to retain a critical mass of Catholic faculty if the college was not to drift into being, you know, just an Iowa college with a very weak Catholic identity. At that point in time, there was intense discussion, which climaxed in a meeting in Moore Hall, the Moore 3 room, which holds, I think, or in those days, held about 120 people at maximum, was filled with faculty. And it was a very frank discussion about the future of the college as a Catholic institution. And
there was a lot of hard feeling, and there were scars that remained for years as a result of that big discussion. I see somebody pointing Father Quigley's name online. That's right. Father Quigley was intensely involved in that, as along with Dr. D'Annunzio, who was, I think, president of the Senate at the time. The question of what was to become of the Catholic identity kind of drifted for years, but if the faculty was no longer going to be quite so solidly Catholic, that meant that the Dominicans were going to have to take a much bigger role, which they did in succeeding years and have done in the first couple of decades of the 21st century. It was decided by Father Shanley about 10 years ago, 9 years ago, to have a re-examination of the Catholic, of the college mission statement. And the result of that, 2 years later, after a lot of discussion, was a broadly accepted statement redefining the mission of Providence College as a Catholic liberal arts college, which would accept people of all religious identities or no religious identities, and people of all ethnic origins and so forth. So it's a statement which is quite universal in terms of its openness to all people, while at the same time reiterating the commitment of the college to learning by both faith and reason. I'm sorry, that was a long-winded response.
Oh, beautiful. So did you ever have to eat dinner in Aquinas Hall wearing a shirt and tie? Does this sound familiar to you?
I did.
Oh, okay.
I did. I wore a tie today for the first time in a couple of months in a public sitting. Yeah. You know, food, this is probably going to be a big issue with people who are tuned in today. And I know some of them worked in the college dining hall. Food is a favorite subject for students to complain about. The students have various options in college dining nowadays, which we didn't have when I was a student. We had hockey pucks on Saturdays, I guess it was, and Roadrunner, which was a scrawny kind of chicken, on Sundays, and something that the students called maggots and worms, which I think would be politely called American chop suey, and other things which were given names that were obscene. And on Friday we had a kind of fish that the students called sewer trout. The diet nowadays is so much better, but students still love to complain about it.
Creative names, if nothing else. I mean, high marks for all of that, right?
Yeah. So that's good.
By the way, to go back just to something a couple of minutes ago, Roy, Peter Clark mentioned something else in the chat window here. He met Art Buchwald years later after the 1970 commencement speech, and Mr. Buchwald cited that speech as one of the remarkable experiences of his life. So made an impression on him too, which is great. How has the question from Katie, how has the CIV program evolved and changed over the years, both the honors program and regular DWC?
Okay, sure. A change in the core curriculum occurred in 2010. And the biggest arguing point in years of discussion about changing the core curriculum was Western civilization. And what happened with the change was that the report of the Committee for Revision of Western Civilization was rejected ultimately by the Faculty Senate. I happen to serve on that committee, so it's a touchy issue with me. But the report of the committee was rejected, and Western Civilization was reduced from a 5-day 20-credit course to 16 credits, which meets three times a week or four times a week now, two seminar hours plus two lecture hours at this point in time. It no longer has a 5-day obligation. The honors program, Western Civilization program, which is the original program. It was a development out of the Great Books program of the 1960s and became the integrated interdisciplinary program in honors in the early 1970s. And that was, well, actually the late 1960s, and that was adopted in a different formulation for the general DWC program. So honors remains the same as it has always been. The large Western civilization sections have three semesters of chronological development and a theme-oriented seminar for the fourth semester. So that's in brief what has happened. Curriculum change tends to be one of the touchiest issues regularly on college campuses. But one of the things that was important about the curriculum that was adopted in 2010 was that it retained the principle of 1971, that the college should have a core curriculum rather than a very open curriculum with few requirements.
Let's look forward a little bit, if you don't mind taking a few more minutes, Richard. We've just drifted past 1 o'clock. You know Father Sicard, who will succeed Father Shanley very well. You've made no secret of your admiration for Father Shanley, and I would guess that you have high hopes for the college's future under Father Sicard's leadership, too.
Yes, yeah. They're on the same page. I think that, you know, if I can talk as simply and as an observer commenting from the visitors gallery, in a sense, because I'm now an emeritus professor and not a member of the ordinary faculty, what I have seen is that is a really good working relationship between them. And one of the issues that has been urgent for both of them in the last 10 years has been diversity, and developing a more diverse student population and a more diverse faculty. And the growth, you know, I don't want to bore you with a lot of statistics, but the growth has been that in the last, well, between 2010 and 2015, when I was gathering information for the college history, the number of Hispanic students and the number of African-American students had doubled in each of those categories. So now I think it's something like 450 students combining the Hispanic and African-American communities on campus. And I know that Father Sicard is very much attached to this issue, and so I can anticipate a lot more attention to this as the years go by.
In a more general sense, what are your hopes and dreams for the future of the college you love so much? What do you see in front of, after, of course, getting through this very difficult period we're in right now?
When I gave my concluding remarks, when Jane Purrell and I were asked to give concluding remarks as we were about to retire 6 years ago, I said that I hoped that I would live long enough to see the centennial, which I have, and I hoped that the college would remain a Catholic college, and I hoped that it would remain a liberal arts college. And in the conclusion of that ceremony, Father Shanley said that he shared my hopes, and so I think I'm in good company.
Absolutely. So one more subject that I know is important to you, and I thought we would wrap up with it, Richard, and that's study abroad. It's something that you consider to be very important to the college experience, something you've participated in a lot over the course of your time here. We'll take a look at a picture of a group of students getting ready in 1974 to leave for Europe with Father Peterson posing with them. So what has this meant to the college and to the educational experience for people who have taken this route when they were students?
I recognize this group, and I was there for that departure. I recognize a lot of people in this group. You know, the study abroad was not a very broad phenomenon in the 1960s when I was at Providence College. There was one student, John Williams, who went to Fribourg when I was an undergraduate. He was the only one in my 4 years at the college who went overseas to study. But subsequently, that grew. It grew particularly in the 1970s. And so that was a big class departing in, that was a class of 75. So they were leaving, I think, in the fall of 73, perhaps. Fribourg was the destination. Fribourg was a good place to be in Europe. We had a resident director there. Larry Guzzi was the resident director for a while. Paul Gallagher was the resident director for a good number of years. And it was a good place to be because it's right in the center of Europe, and you could be in Berlin or Vienna or in Paris in a few hours. It was a lovely old, in many ways, still medieval city. But subsequently, the college suspended having its own resident director there and went to a much broader kind of opportunity so that students might study in South Africa or Japan. We retained programs for a while with the University of Glasgow, where my son Ben went to school, and with Blackfriars College at Oxford University. And we also had a summer program, summer study program in Pietrasanta, Italy, which was the town where Michelangelo lived when he quarried his marble at Monte Altissimo. And that was my experience for 3 summers in the 70s with the study abroad program being in Pietrasanta, which is only 5 kilometers off the Mediterranean and has some remnants of the old city wall dating back to Michelangelo's time. One last thing, though, about study abroad. There were a couple of problems in the study abroad program that persisted for quite a long time until the college finally faced up to them and made some changes, which Father Shanley supported, I think, because he had the experience of going to Fribourg himself as an undergraduate. One was the partial year residence. If a student were going overseas for one semester of his or her junior year, there was no assurance that they were going to get on-campus housing for the other semester. And so that was a deterrent. And the other thing was that students had to pay the whole freight once they went overseas, even if they had academic scholarships or financial aid in another respect from Providence College. And so the college made all scholarships portable. And these two things, making the scholarships portable and making arrangements for students to live on campus for one semester if they're going overseas for the other semester, those made it possible for a lot more students to go overseas. Nowadays, we do have a program in Rome, which was established by the theology department, and there is a resident director there for that program. And the college is just about to start a program in London, which would be connected to the Western Civ requirement in the core curriculum. So that's in the offing, I think, to begin next year.
So, yes, indeed. That sounds like a wonderful program, and students are very interested in it. So very
excited. I would be.
I bet. Well, we can't thank you enough for your time today, Richard. This has been wonderful. We're so fortunate to have you in our community and to have you there to help us understand the college's origins and its impact, and really to provide the insights that we need to fully appreciate what the institution is all about. So thank you so much. We hope you and Mrs. Grace have a wonderful summer.
If I can just say one more thing, Joe, it is that there are so many other names of people who were colleagues that students will remember that I wish I could have recited. People like Fabe Cunningham and Paul Philibert and Gus Cody and Dr. Edwin Gora, Rodney De La Santa, and Paul Thompson and Rainey Fort. And we've had such a wonderful faculty experience. And I have to mention Pat McKay at the end because he had such an influence as academic vice president. So here's a toast to them all.
Can you identify this person for us?
That's Rodney Della Santa, who succeeded me as director of the honors program. And he did a wonderful job at that.
Appears to be in the library and...
That's in the library.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
Very good. You're a good friend, I know, and had that picture waiting for you to say his name. So, that is very good. So once again, thank you so much, Richard. We appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for joining us. It's been a nice afternoon, and we appreciate your interest, and go Friars.
Go Friars.
Thank you for joining us today. Providence College podcasts are available at all the usual places, including the college's YouTube channel. For our producer, Chris Judge, I'm Joe Carr. Until next time.